Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Richard Falk is Chair of Global Law, Queen Mary University, London. He received a law degree from Yale Law School and a Doctor of Juridical Science from Harvard Law School. After teaching international law and criminal law at Ohio State University, he was appointed a professor of international law at Princeton University, and for several decades was the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice. He is the author or co-author of more than 20 books and the editor or co-editor of numerous others. He has not only been a prolific author, but is regarded by his peers as a pioneer thinker dedicated to peace and justice. Not only has he influenced the views of a generation of scholars in his role as teacher and thinker, but during 40 years at Princeton University, Professor Falk was also active in seeking an end to wars, the strengthening and upholding of fundamental human rights, the promotion of respect for international law, and improve democracy in numerous countries of the world. Over the past decade, he has been nominated many times for a Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of his ability to bridge the gap between his work as a brilliant scholar with his desire to see peace and security to be tangible realities on the ground. His political memoir, Public Intellectual, The Life of a Citizen Pilgrim, was published on February 16 by Clarity Press. Professor Falk, thank you for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We are honored by your presence and thankful for making the time to talk to us. I would like to begin our conversation by going back to an article you wrote in the journal Foreign Affairs in 2001 with the provocative title Toward Global Parliament. I remember being delighted not only by the persuasive nature of the arguments that you and your co-author, Andrew Strauss, put forward, but also pleasantly surprised that a hard-nosed journal such as Foreign Affairs thought it entirely appropriate to open its pages for you to put forward the idea that at the turn of the millennium, we needed to take a look at the UN system that was created in 1945 and explore ways to improve it. For the benefit of our audience, can you share with us the two or three key ideas you presented in that seminal piece of work?
Well, thank you very much. It's really good to be with you and to share this conversation that we're about to have. I was somewhat surprised myself when Foreign Affairs agreed to accept the piece. It's not within their normal spectrum of analytic or policy-oriented writing. But I think that the points we were trying to make really did resonate with that sense of world order needs and desirable developments in that period, particularly, I think, the idea of a greater participation at the international level by civil society and its representatives. So a global parliament was a vehicle for creating that kind of participation in a more high-profiled way than and even now exists in the UN system. And then I think the experience of a evolving European Parliament was also a part of the background in that willingness to think about whether the same kind of institutional development would be useful in a global context. And My own interest in this kind of idea had developed through my participation for several years in an annual event at Perugia, Italy, called the UN of the Peoples, in which representatives of countries gathered in Perugia, and they represented self-consciously a people's perspective rather than a governmental perspective. And you did get a sense that a different kind of agenda emerged, policy agenda emerged, that was more responsive to the, what should I say, to the urgencies of the poor, marginalized, and vulnerable, as well as more concerned with longer range developments of a peaceful and just world order. And it made me feel that the tension between that kind of perspective, those kinds of perspectives, and the sort of governmentally statist-oriented perspectives that UN General Assembly and Security Council debates exemplify, that was a creative tension that would be good and helpful. So I think those three elements were important in my own thinking at that time.
The idea of a global parliament was also seen, I think, by many as a way of strengthening the democratic legitimacy of the United Nations, establishing a stronger connection, right, between the UN and the people.
Well, that's part of what I meant by the participation of civil society in a more high-profile way, that created the sense that this was less of a governmental oligarchy and more of a at least emergent democratic set of institutions.
2020 will most likely be remembered mainly for the calamities brought about by COVID-19. But it also happened to be the 75th anniversary of the adoption of the UN Charter, as you well know. You have given much thought in your distinguished career to the kinds of reforms or innovations which would be desirable to strengthen the mechanism of international cooperation against a background of the many unresolved problems that we face today. Accelerating climate change, which is very much on the news every day, nuclear proliferation, which remains a problem today as it was 30, 40 years ago, widening income disparities, and so on. Can you outline for us briefly what you see as the most desirable innovations for the UN's next 25 years?
That's a tricky question in a way, because what's desirable doesn't seem to be very feasible, and what's feasible doesn't seem to correspond to what is really needed. And so my responses somehow straddle the distinction between feasibility and desirability in response to my understanding of what's really necessary to preserve a benevolent human future. And so I would start with either the limitation of the veto in the Security Council or its elimination. The veto is a real exception to the commitment to uphold the Charter and to respect international legal authority. It's a geopolitical exception, right of exception, that's built into the constitutional structure of the UN and is at odds with the kind of future that the UN proclaims in its own preamble and really in the operational UN as described in the Charter itself. So I think that some kind of veto-less Security Council would enormously enhance both the legitimacy of the UN and its effectiveness in its cardinal role of war prevention and peaceful settlement of disputes, but also generally in achieving the kinds of adjustments that are called for, including in the area of climate change and biodiversity. I would also think that a great deal would be achieved by finally adopting this proposal that's been around forever to have a more independent funding base for UN operations. In other words, have some sort of international revenue-generating tax on transnational travel or on financial transactions. There have been a whole on certain kinds of trade. There have been all kinds of proposals made over the years. But again, the P5 in particular, the permanent members of the Security Council, don't want to give up their entrenched interests in really retaining this control over how the organization operates. And so it's been very difficult to achieve these two most fundamental and needed changes if one's goal is a more effective United Nations. I think that the third thing I would mention is much greater emphasis on demilitarization and denuclearization. The one thing I didn't fully agree with in the way you posed the question is to emphasize non-proliferation rather than denuclearization and demilitarization. Because the proliferation regime is itself, in my view, a distortion of a just and equitable world order. It's a form of nuclear apartheid, in effect, where a few countries have not only have the possession of the weaponry, but they have no, they've accepted no responsibility with regard to its use or further development or threats, and it creates a hierarchical world order system that, in my view, is quite unhealthy. So it's obviously desirable not to have additional nuclear powers, but to think of nuclear proliferation as the objective of a desirable future for the UN and for the world generally seems not a helpful way of thinking about the problem of war and violence and risk that this kind of system has involved. And it's been used very arbitrarily. For instance, Israel is allowed to develop nuclear weapons and remains unaccountable, whereas Iraq was subject to aggression because it was alleged to have a nuclear program, and Iran has been subject to persistent threats because it's supposedly seeking nuclear weapons, while the other nine nuclear weapon states have no regulatory restraints that they're willing to accept whatsoever.
And yet, I think on the positive side, we did have the 2017 Treaty on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons, which I thought was a very encouraging sign that at least, you know, more than 100 countries have signed off to. What was your view on that treaty?
I was very positive also about it, and it came into force just now on January 22nd when the 51st country ratified the treaty and submitted that to the UN Secretary General. But the P5 have issued a statement saying this treaty is irrelevant. We believe that the peace of the world is maintained by deterrence, and we have problems with countries like North Korea and Iran, and we're committed to proliferation. Part of the reason I took up the issue of proliferation as a questionable policy focus is precisely because I think the direction that it would be desirable to move in is this treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons. But it is seen as undermining the kind of regime that the nuclear weapon states have evolved, and they pretend to see nuclear disarmament as an ultimate goal, but what their behavior suggests is rather stabilizing the management of nuclear weapons, not the transformation of the system from nuclear to non-nuclear.
Can one assume that as a result of COVID-19, there will be greater willingness, perhaps, on the part of the major UN shareholders to move in the direction of modernizing our UN system, to adapt it to the requirements of the 21st century, and our much greater connectivity and interdependence, or rather, will it take a much bigger crisis than COVID-19 to push us in that direction? Much like it took World War II and 60 million casualties to give birth to the United Nations.
I'm not very optimistic about the impact, this kind of constructive impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. And partly for reasons additional to what you mentioned, the scope and depth of the crisis, I would also mention the absence of effective global leadership at this stage. The U.S. played a role of this sort after World War II that was very instrumental, I think, in creating a generally benevolent, not altogether benevolent, but generally benevolent post-1945 international environment. Now, it's not only that there are not leaders with a visionary or even a liberal internationalist outlook, but the internal politics of most of the important countries in the world are dominated by very nationalist preoccupations and are not as sympathetic as in the past to global institutionalization, and therefore are not as likely to be supportive of strengthening the UN. The autocratic leaders around the world have led, in my view, to a kind of resurgent nationalism, chauvinistic nationalism. And that works against the spirit of global institutions. And this is very tragic for the future because, from a functional point of view, never has it been more important and necessary and urgent to move, as your question suggested, toward a stronger UN system and a stronger body of international and regional institutions that would address some of these global challenges confronting the world at the present time, and challenges that can't be solved by individual countries acting on their own, even if they act rather benevolently, which itself takes a leap of faith to suppose that this will happen.
Your comments remind me about something Albert Einstein said about nationalism. I think he called it an infantile disease. And I think he was expressing the hope that maybe World War II would have cured us from it, but I guess that's not yet the case. Whenever I have talked about the future of global governance and the prospects for greater international cooperation, I have found it often useful to allay the fears of the skeptics to mention the experience of the European Union, to which you have already made allusion. What started out in 1957 as six nations coming together to trade more freely has evolved into an imperfect, but it seems to me an innovative machinery where 27 nations have created supranational institutions. There is a European Parliament, an executive branch, the European Court of Justice, a central bank, and so on, to establish a strong legal basis for peaceful cooperation. Do you agree with the statement that this suggests that it is possible for nations, to use your own words, to move away from our war system in which international decisions are still made by heavily armed nations that are poised to destroy each other? Those are your words.
I shouldn't be eating them then. My feeling was very optimistic and positive about the development of the EU system up until about 7 or 8 years ago. I felt that that kind of institutional experiment, which was interesting because, of course, it was Europe that invented the state system, and now it looked as though Europe was inventing the most radical innovation of the state system moving toward a meaningful regional order. But I think the economic recession of 2008, 2009, and then the subsequent developments around the refugee issue suggested that when pressures rise, the statist nature of Europe again becomes very formidable as an obstacle to regional cooperation on the most urgent issues of the day. Having said that, I still think that if there's a new normal, and the nature of larger challenges are confronted, that the European Union concept may have a new surge of growth and development. And that may be actually accelerated by the realization that Europe should stop depending to the extent it has on the United States as its security blanket, so to speak, and act as a more autonomous force that would lead it to enter into a more ambitious program of institutional unification so that it could compete with other formidable political actors in the world economy and elsewhere. So I'm guardedly optimistic, going back to your prior question, that the post-COVID response in Europe will be more robust than the post-COVID response at the global level.
I guess the history of the European Union has always been one of two steps forward, one step back, right?
Yes.
It is difficult to bring 27 nations together to work together, recognize common interests, and to put ancient nationalisms, in the back burner. My own sense is that they're making an effort and succeeding in some ways, from time to time.
I think one questionable move from the point of view of building a robust European Union was the enlargement moves that took place at the end of the Cold War in the early 90s and brought into the European Union a group of states that were not really oriented around the liberal democratic constitutionalism that the main European actors previously had enjoyed. And it made it a more sensitive to the relationship to Russia and to Asia than probably it would have otherwise been. So I think that even though enlargement was tempting because it created a bigger community and a bigger economic base, it had its disadvantages by weakening the sense of what one might call normative consensus or political legitimacy based on democratic values. So that I think Europe is in a period itself of transition to seeing whether it can transcend those differences and resume a period of going two steps forward.
With your permission, I would like to ask you a question which I raised with the UN Undersecretary General Fabrizio Hochschild when I interviewed him last month. When Glenbert Clark and Louis Sun wrote World Peace Through World Law in the late 50s, putting forward an ambitious set of reforms for the UN Charter, their proposals fell on deaf ears. By then, as you know, we were in the middle of the Cold War and had entered, in fact, the arms race, and a period characterized by countless violations of the letter and the spirit of the UN Charter. Is the world today more ready for something like the Clarkson prescriptions than it was in the 1950s and 60s?
Well, it's an interesting speculation. Louis Sohn was a teacher of mine when I was a student at Harvard Law School, so I was quite closely exposed to those proposals, the Clarkson proposals, which had emerged rather close to the time I was a student there. I would say my real answer, I think, would be no. The world is functionally more in need of that kind of reform of the UN, strengthening it and making it a more effective problem-solving institutional set of arrangements. But I don't think the political traction exists at all, either at elite levels of policy making or in any important part of the world, or at the civil society levels of mass action. I see no pressure to move toward those kinds of coherent reforms, particularly through this kind of legalistic mechanisms. And I was always, I must admit, skeptical of a Western set of proposals that were seeking to globalize their influence on the basis, essentially, of what had worked well in the U.S. without the participation of non-Western thought in the devising of those proposals. So I felt they were, what shall I say, civilizationally deficient from the outset and really were, in a way, a kind of fantasy that the world would be fine if it was just like the U.S.
Interesting. Richard, to comment, on a couple of observations that were made by two distinguished scholars who reviewed our book, Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century. Payam Akhavan is a professor at McGill University and Oxford, and he said, far from naive idealism, building effective global institutions in the 21st century is a matter of survival for our species. And if you have read Yuval Harari's book, Sapiens, he essentially makes the same point in the latter part of the book. Having given thought to these issues for a long, long time in your professional career, do you agree?
I do essentially agree, but I again think that without political traction, perspective misses the crisis, as I understand it, which is that we have these issues that can't be resolved except by moving toward this kind of global institutionalization. And it does, as Payam suggests, create a kind of extinction danger for the species. But at the same time, the political movements at a national level are much less inclined to undertake the kind of reformist steps that are implied. They are more nationalistic, not less nationalistic, than they were 20, 50, 75 years ago. And in that sense, one can say, well, maybe this is the moment of the sunset of statism, and that comes just before the dawn of a new political globalism. But there's not much evidence that I see at the present time. I wish I did see it, but I don't see the evidence for saying this is a politically viable scenario for the future, despite being so functionally urgent to achieve.
Yeah, that seems to be the great dilemma of our age. You know, Richard Cooper, whom you may have met, he was a very insightful international economist at Harvard, someone for whom I have had great respect over the decades, and who eventually became a friend. He said that the current UN-based system of governance is not up to dealing satisfactorily with 21st century problems. And then he suggested that in a world of nationalistic states devoted to narrow national sovereignty, change is slow, but that can derive some hope from today's youth, who seem to be much more at ease with the idea of stronger international cooperation in the search for solutions to our global problems. Is our current predicament then in the hands of tomorrow's political leaders? Do we have to just write off the current generation of nationalistic-minded leaders and simply can we afford to wait?
We can't afford to wait, but we have no choice but to wait, because the existing leaders are not inclined to move in the directions that you and Richard Cooper and I all agree are necessary. See, that, as you put it, that's the dilemma. How do you get political traction for the necessary kinds of adaptive changes that one needs in the world order system? I'd also raise a question about Richard Cooper's stress on nationalism and statism. I think the fundamental issue is the geopolitical management of power by a few states. It's not so much nationalism, which in my own past thinking, I've also often spoken in very much the same way as Richard did in your formulation of the question. But I've come to think that the primacy of geopolitics is the essence of the problem, that these states that are above the law, above, not accountable, practice double standards. They want to apply law to the weak, but the strong are left free to act as they wish. I think that's the fundamental problem. And how you tackle that problem is something that each of these societies probably has to address on a national level, because it would be possible. Certainly, if you take the United States, at one point it was much more inclined toward internationalist ways of promoting its own national interests. Trump was a regressive retreat from that kind of view, and we can be a little bit hopeful that Biden will at least restore some of that internationalist vigor that had been previously characteristic of the U.S. worldview. But it was a worldview that was always very protective of its geopolitical room for maneuver. And it's not different in that way than Russia or China. France and the UK are a sort of special case that are more limited in their capabilities and also in their ambitions at this point. But the issue is, I really think the focus needs to be less on statism and more on geopolitics.
Let me pose a final question, which I think makes eminent sense in terms of what you have just said over the last half an hour. You know, at the Global Governance Forum, we are making special efforts to reach to young people who will perhaps bear the brunt of our current inaction, for instance, on the climate change front. Can you please send a message to them? How can they rise to the challenges of this century without losing hope?
Well, I think that Greta Thunberg already has, in a way, galvanized youth, and at least in the context of climate change. And when she addressed the UN and said to the assembled delegates, you will die of old age, but we will die from global warming, she summarized that intergenerational challenge that I think is so important to evolve, and that the way you get change, in my view, or at least non-incremental, more drastic forms of change, is from below, from a movement that could be very effectively spearheaded by the young, who have the most at stake in making adjustments that are more sensitive to the long-term challenges or the middle-term challenges. Part of the existing system that is so defective is what might be called short-termism, the performance of political leaders and of corporate managers is overwhelmingly shaped by what they do in a very short period of time. So the temptation to maximize gains at the moment and put off problems of a deeper and longer duration is great. But the real message to the young is struggle for what you believe, because the future is uncertain and the risks are high. So you have an enormous amount to gain if your sense of a emancipatory future is realized, and nothing to lose. And you will lose a lot if the present trends are allowed to remain unchallenged.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for those very thoughtful and wise words. You're still going so strong and are such a fount of wisdom and experience and hope, really. It's been an honor to have you with us. And I'm really very grateful for you, for your making the time available.
Well, thank you, Augusto. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.